Hey yo, and here we go, another episode of We Talk Music on the Air and in your ear. Once again, I am Martin, joined by, I don't know, he's the best booker in the business and the king of the casters. He is Mr. Brett Podcast. Brett, I know you're excited for this one.
I am absolutely excited for this one. As a gentleman that, you know, I've been following his career now for 30 years. And
hey, that's not a positive way to start a interview.
I thought you'd appreciate that, but anyways, we have the singer, guitarist. He's played with Saigon Kick, Super Transatlantic, and of course, right now he has songs for the Apocalypse with Jason Bieler and the Baron von Bielski Orchestra. Jason Bieler, how are you?
I am doing fantastic, and I want to say I am chuffed to bits that you were the first interview I've done that actually pronounced the name of the record right. And I designed it to make people stumble over it, and you executed it flawlessly, and you'll be the recipient of a Samsung toaster. I just wanted to let you know.
Ooh, all right.
Is that smart wonderful technology? Because I got Samsung everything in my house.
It should be.
Yeah, it should be.
All right.
Well, something's got to be smart, so let's. that'll be a great start. So anyways, I mean, you've got the wonderful new album and I mean, all these wonderful new guests. I mean, it's coming out, I guess it's January 22nd. So why don't you tell us about it and why it came to be with the Baron von Bielski Orchestra instead of just Jason Bieler?
I had been asked, started talking to Nick Teeter, a gentleman from Frontiers Records, and he started talking about doing something together. And while I still have my own label, I was like, if I don't do this with somebody else, I'm just going to find a million reasons to never finish, because that's just the way things work. So I felt if I had an obligation to turn it in, it would be helpful. And so around March, I started writing it. And by May, give or take, we were done with the whole record. And I guess the thing was, I was just going to, you know, try to call up about 25 or 30 of my friends and see if they wanted to participate in some way, assuming that just due to the nature of life or whatever else was going on, that, you know, three or four would say yes and everyone else would be on tour or making their own record or in the middle of something else. And they all wound up saying yes, which is just brilliant. And I mean, it was just a dream come true to be able to make. I mean, the whole point, the greatest part of this record for me was just to be able to be creative with these guys that I love and think the world of, and each in their own right are just complete badasses. So that was the whole goal. I mean, the record, you know, at that point, just finishing it with them was like, okay, this is amazing. And the fact now that the record's starting to receive a little bit of momentum and people are digging it is just icing on the cake. It's you know, just amazing.
When you went in to write this album, like, were you writing it kind of like in the moment, or were these songs that you had around for a little while? And especially when it comes to like a little bit of the progressive feel, was that something that you kind of wanted to add to this?
You know, everything was written in March during the process. So there was nothing. I wanted to make sure that the record was reflective of whatever time the record was from. I didn't want to like go into the back catalog of stuff or, you know, start pulling demos from other things. I wanted it to be for this record. And it's funny, I never really thought of myself as a prog person. What kind of happened was about a year and a half ago, I wound up doing a lot of work with Jonathan Mover, the drummer, Ryo Akamoto, who plays in Spock's Beard, Michael Sadler from Saga, and a gentleman named Matt Dorsey. And they were doing this project that involved like a ton of the old prog, like old King Crimson, Bill Bruford, Genesis. Like, and it's like, they asked me like, you know, I was like, I'd never heard any of this stuff. Like, you know, Genesis to me started with like maybe the very end of Peter Gabriel, with like The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway and stuff. But I think by hearing all that music for the first time and discovering it and becoming a fan of the King Crimson stuff, it just opened my mind to like more rhythmic and more tonal possibilities. It just kind of spread my brain a little bit. So I think some of that kind of got into my, you know, my ecosystem, not intentionally, but just by, you know, working, having some of that stuff in my head. And it's just so funny now, because all of a sudden the record is getting on the, you know, the prog metal Spotify playlist and it's getting really supported in all these prog things, which has been unbelievable. And it's really rewarding, because no one has any clue who Saigon Kick is from that world. So it's like on these playlists with like Steven Wilson and Devin Townsend and all these things. And it's just kind of a really funny, rewarding, you know, process so far.
Yeah, I do find it fascinating, because of course, when you go through your catalog, I mean, from Saigon Kick, and I mean, I'm a huge fan of Saigon Kick, and then Super Transatlantic, which just has a totally different feel, and now, and even your solo work, your earlier solo work, and now into this, I mean, you do kind of try to reinvent yourself, and I really appreciate that. But one of the things that I absolutely love about your music is just the harmonies and the melodies just are always there.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, I was just having this conversation the other day. Like, you know, I don't consider myself a singer per se. Like, Jeff Scott Soto is a singer, and Tal Dottore is a singer. But I do think I have a sound, and that kind of carries forward. And that's, you know, but some of my favorite artists do have sounds, like, you know, Perry Farrell or Tom, not comparing myself to those great people, but Tom Waits or Bjork, or they kind of develop an artistic sound. And that my interpretation of melodies and stuff is so warped by the amount of music I listen to that, you know, I listen to everything from, you know, I've said it a thousand times, like Barry Manilow to Meshuggah and, you know, everything in between. And it just gets all put in this bizarre, you know, juice tiger of a blender brain that I have, and winds up all getting kind of spewed out in its own way.
One of the things about the album that I really love is actually the album cover, and that kind of translates into the website and also the music video for Apology and Bring Out the Dead as well, the lyric video for that. But so where did the album cover, the design of that come from, the idea, and who worked on it with you?
A gentleman named Robert Merrick, who is the boy genius, but I don't want you to get him too famous or he's going to charge me a lot more for the next record.
Yep, that's always a problem.
Yes. You know, it's the first time ever that I've been able to do something and work with artists that kind of understood what was happening. And really, I think the visual, like you said, really represents what's on the record. It feels like a part of the process versus let's just stick that out there so we can put a record out. Or that's a neat picture, let's put that on the record. So yeah, Robert's just unbelievable. And he's the guy who does, I don't know if you follow me on social media at all, but all the insane Photoshop stuff, he does all that stuff. So, you know, he's just a boy genius. And a gentleman named Wayne Joyner, with a illustrator named Lucas, I can't even say his last name, like Wormbisher, I think. From Brazil, did all the illustrations and stuff like that for that first video for Apology. And the same thing, I thought they just, you know, I always kind of open, just because of a long music career, you tend to open every resulting email or project with a sense of dread, like, here we go, it's going to just be a disaster. And both those guys just crushed it, in my opinion.
It's no question about it. I think Apology is got a strong lead for Video of the Year. It's going to take a hell of an effort from somebody else to top that.
Oh,
it's
thanks,
a beautiful piece.
Yeah, I those guys, you know, I'd like to take credit for it. I think my beautiful face is what the inspiration was that they used to. But no, they just did a great job. Like it's like I said, it's one of the first few times. Like usually when anything I've done in the past, you know, there's a bit of a cringe going on internally where I knew that could have been different or that's not spot on. But in the sense of that video and the cover and all the artwork, I really am quite proud of it.
We mentioned Apology and then Bring Out Your Dead. I think I might have said Bring Out the Dead before, but Bring Out Your Dead are the first two singles. And one of the things about this album is I could imagine almost everybody you talk to gives you a different favorite. So what are you going to do for the third single?
I think it's going to be – we're going to go with Beyond Hope, which has Benji from Skindred and has Bumblefoot and also David Ellison. And a friend of mine, Ricky Sanders, who actually played on the Super Transatlantic stuff with me. Will probably be the next one. I mean, I think it's always, you know, what I've done or been a part of is just records that I guess the people that dig what I do are super encouraging in the sense that they don't want to know what happens next. And I think if I made a record that was all one thing or felt like kind of linear in that sense, they'd really be more disappointed. They kind of want to have the ride make a really sharp turn and be challenged. And the older I get, the more fortunate I feel that I've been able to cultivate that base. Like, it's really neat to have a group of people that go like, dude, that's just too expected.
Anthem for Losers is my personal favorite. And that's the thing about this album is, as I say, I imagine every listen, I think that I would get something new. I've listened to it twice now. Every listen, I think I'm going to grab something new and might gravitate to something different.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I like I said, and obviously that has a lot to do with some of the amazing contributions from everybody, you know, and their diversity as musicians and just the contributions that they gave all gave these songs a little bit of different flavors. I mean, you know, even a guy like Kevin Scott, who played bass on Apology, You know, he plays with, he played on the last John McLaughlin tour, and he plays with Jimmy Herring and Wayne Krantz and kind of that whole aquarium rescue unit scene, or the underground New York jazz scene, you know, like Bar 55 stuff. So it's like so neat that him and Bumblefoot and, you know, Clay from the Zac Brown Band is on a record with Devin Townsend. But I think I'm most proud that it just doesn't sound forced or shoehorned. Everybody kind of played really interesting things within the world that the songs kind of had, at least to me. So.
Yeah. How did you choose, like, who got to be on which song?
I'd love to say it was, like, this masterful plan that I PowerPointed out and took everybody's, you know, did a big spreadsheet of everybody's catalogs and the value of each one. And it just kind of – one of those beautiful moments where everything just fell into place. And, you know, every time I'd get a file or a song or a solo or a bit or a piece, it's like I was just like, man, that's just so – you know, but – it doesn't take a genius to figure out if you ask David Ellison to play bass on something, you're probably going to get a good bass track, if not amazing. You know, yeah. Devin Townsend's probably going to do something pretty amazing. Bumblefoot tends to be a really good guitar player. So Butch Walker has been known to write a couple of hit songs in his day.
One or two, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, I think the when you pick A-level players, it's kind of obvious that they're going to kill it. I mean, the best part, I think, was probably, too, that we weren't together where my influence had anything to do with what they did. Like, they were able to sit in their own private studios on their own time and be creative and finish their vision without even the slightest look at an eyebrow being raised or a could you do, you know. So it was really important for me to get a pure version of what these guys do with no interference.
How did you then go through and kind of, like, did you put that – their work over top of your work, or did you kind of redo your work as their work came in?
The bulk of the record was all written. So their parts and pieces all kind of fit in, like, you know, there was already holes for those things. Or I might have had like just a pilot based thing, or a riff, you know, so they kind of had an idea of what was happening prior to their part being needed. But yeah, it was all the songs were written and done before they were sent to the people.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm interested in for sure is like, you talk about the process of this one, like how different is the process of this versus the process of Saigon Kick?
Not tremendously, man. A lot of the Saigon Kick stuff I demoed out myself and kind of did the general sketching of how the songs were going to go, both harmony lines and things like that, for the vast majority of it. Not all of it, but the vast majority of it. The technology's gotten so much better that I can work a little bit more. I can work really quickly. Like I can jump from song to song. Like the great thing about the way the technology is now is I can literally be working on one song, click a switch, and now I'm exactly where I was on the other song. You know, and so I can just constantly be stimulated and never be like feel like I'm. You know, in the old days, you'd sit there and work on a drum sound for 2 days and just hear the snare drum going over and over and over, and you'd be like, "We're gonna kill yourself." So now you can literally go, you know, string section to you know, samples to vocals to instantaneously. So I find it really freeing and a little bit more creative.
Yeah, it's one of the really interesting things I think about, you know, people that have had, you know, careers and in different, you know, and kind of move through the genres like you do is also, and I guess one of the things that I wonder about too is, did you have record label interference where you don't have that now?
You know, I think I've always been so, the music's always been diverse and what I do has been kind of specific to me. Even back when we were working with Jason Flom, I mean, he was like, he literally sat with me, he's like, I have no idea what the fuck you're doing. Like, I seriously don't know what to tell you. Just, I guess just go do it and we'll all hope for the best. And that's, so I never really had a lot of interference. And even Michael Wagner, who's a genius, when we did the first record, really kind of, he set up an environment for us to execute that. He wasn't really so much concerned with like getting in there and changing things as much as setting up the right vibe and getting it recorded and, you know, making a record where we didn't even feel like we were making a record.
You of all people would, of course, know what a good record label, you know, is and does. And what makes for a good record label?
In this day and age, it's obviously all changed. You know, for our label, when we were doing stuff with Skindred and Nonpoint and Sixth and, you know, a Carnival and all these bands, it was just I heard these bands and I felt like insanely passionate that more people had to hear them. And I got that from, you know, being friends with Flom back in the day, Jason Flom. I mean, he would literally, like, he was known for, like, standing on someone's desk and yelling, like, you know, I'm not leaving your office until we get this video budget, you know, and I have to, you know, I have to go to the bathroom and I'm not getting off your desk. So you have a limited amount of time here. And but I mean, like, and literally people would go like, just get out of my office, whatever, here's the check, and like make things happen. And so I always carried that forward with my view of stuff. So I mean, I think passion and trying to do the right thing, I mean, it's not always going to work, you know, for a variety of reasons. You know, sometimes it's the artist, sometimes it's the manager, sometimes it's the label, sometimes all those things are doing great and it's just the wrong time, or you know, just so you but you can never fault passion, I think. So to me, that's the most important thing. People are that are intending to do and trying to do the best they can do.
One of the things that I love about you too is your personality, and I think it really comes through on the songs. But it does, you know, as Martin was talking about earlier, just with the look of the videos. Like, how much of that as well speaks to your personality and just the fun? You know, you talk about the Bielski winter residence and the with the house staff and the groundskeepers and such, and you know, how much of that is you know, permeates your career?
I mean, comedy and just humor in general is it's the way I communicated for the time I was a child. I mean, the only bonding I remember even like is sitting and watching, you know the, you know, Inspector Clouseau movies with my dad, with Peter Sellers, or something. You know, that, I mean, that was like the biggest thing in my life. So to me, I mean, along with music, I am always looking for the more obscure, irrelevant, or just irreverent thing to say in a conversation. Even live, it's become a very bad habit because Jeff Soto and I were doing a bunch of acoustic shows, and it was kind of like our, you know, a poor man's attempt at getting into comedy. but I became like twistedly addicted to making obscure references that even the crowd didn't get. So like nothing was more addicting to me than an awkward silence became what I guess a normal comedian would want to have, roaring laughter. But like when everybody in the crowd went like, what? Like that was my like crack. I was like, oh, this is the greatest thing ever. No one knows what I'm talking about except for maybe one person. And if I can get that one person to make eye contact and go like, I know what you're talking about, I just felt like I had achieved the highest level of creativity. So it's important in everything I do. I mean, look, life's too short, man. If you're not laughing, what are you doing?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, no, it's fantastic. And I mean, I can only imagine, like, how did Jeff take it when you do that kind of thing? Like, how do you work with other people? Like, what do they think of your sense of humor in that regard?
Jeff's obviously super funny, and yes, he loves it. I mean, that we're at a point where, like, especially those acoustic shows we did, where it's like so much fun because it's like just us guys getting together and going out. And so you want to go to Chicago and L.A. and let's do Dallas or whatever, and we'll go eat, we'll have fun. And then a bunch of these people show up, and like I said, the crowds are so – all the shows wind up starting to sell out, and they're all there to have it. Like, they really don't care what we do. So if we do, like, 3 songs and say something insane for an hour and a half, they're thrilled. If we do 20 songs and we say 2 funny things, they're thrilled. If we do all obscure covers, they're thrilled. I mean, they're just so into the vibe of what's going on that it's like, the most fun you can really have.
It's actually funny because Jeff is due to – we've talked to him a couple times before, but he's due to be our next interview. So what's a question we can ask him where he would immediately go, oh, shit, that came from Jason?
That's a rough question. you could tell him Wason wants to know how his love muffin's doing.
I don't even know, but as long as he knows, that's okay.
I just know his wife hates it.
That's fantastic. Well, yeah, I mean, because it's always so much fun. And I mean, it must feel so good to know that you're at a point in your career where you can, you know, just get together with all these guys and go out and know that you do have that audience that will come and see you no matter what. I mean, it does feel like that kind of, you know, fish kind of motif in a way.
The responsibility is to make people have a wonderful night. And what we do to try to achieve that may change on a consistent basis. That's the goal. I mean, you know, they're not there just because we're there. I mean, although I like to think of Jeff and I as the Prince and Michael Jackson of 90s metal. it's not like that kind of thing where they feel obligated, but I mean, people are just having a great time, which ultimately makes us have more fun. And to do it with Jeff, I mean, I don't know how much of our history you know, but Jeff gave me my first professional gig ever.
Like, yeah, when I was that's right.
Talisman, yeah. We've known each other since, like, literally forever. He's probably my oldest, one of my oldest friends. And you can tell him that because he's much older than me. So, yeah, but I mean, so we've known each other forever, and it's just such a blast to be able to do that. Look, I mean, I've been a musician and, you know, professionally since I'm 18 years old, and built a nice life. And it doesn't go past me that I'm so fortunate for that. And, you know, there's a lot of super talented people that are working at Denny's or construction or, you know, as Walmart greeters that are more talented than Jeff and I that just haven't been as fortunate. So,
but they didn't write Love Is on the Way. So that's,
no, they did not kill hair metal with one song.
It's actually funny. You know, I think about, you guys came up, you know, through the Miami club scene and instead of the Sunset Strip. So how do you think that, influences your sound and your music and shaped it over the years differently than it might've been if you guys had been, you know, out in LA?
I think it was wonderfully freeing in hindsight because we weren't, like you were saying, in L.A., there was 100 bands rehearsing in the same place, wearing the same clothes and thinking the same things. And some of them were great. So it's not a dig by any means. But in our scene, it was like we had bands like Nuclear Valdez, the Miami Sound Machine, Marilyn Manson, us. And then even going back historically, you had Tom Petty or Molly Hatchet or – you know, or out of Tampa, obviously just tons of the great death metal bands, Sabotage.
Yes.
None of which have anything to do with each other.
Yeah.
But we all knew each other, you know, I mean, and you know, like Marilyn Manson painted the combat boots on the back of our first Saigon Kick record. You know, he did the first interview with Saigon Kick that was ever printed in a college paper. So it's like we were all connected, but we didn't feel this need to be doing the same exact things. So, and I think that's just because we were in this bizarre, it's like Florida doesn't have a culture of its own because everybody there is from somewhere else, especially South Florida. So like, even if you're a fan of a sports team or a hockey team, like, you know, I'm a big hockey fan, I used to go see the Panthers play all the time. Anytime like the Montreal Canadiens would come down or the Detroit Red Wings or, you know, the Rangers, the place would be mobbed with like 90% fans from those teams. And I think just Florida's got this weird, like, non-centered, non-focused environment that lets a lot of weird things happen.
That's I think one of the things I know that Martin and I are fascinated by is the history of these kind of things in music and the scenes that exist. And, you know, it's fascinating to hear you talk about Florida because, I mean, Sabotage is one of my all-time favorite bands. I absolutely love what they do, and there's so many people that have come out of Florida that are, I mean, Nuclear Valdez, great band. So it is interesting, given the differences, that you would all kind of know each other.
Yeah, I mean, even though I forgot to mention the Mavericks, which went on to massive country success, those guys came out of Florida too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a strange place. As you know by the constant updates about Florida, man. should give you every indication of North Carolina. Yeah, it's not safe. It's not a safe place to live in Florida. I mean, I love my friends down there, but it's a comedy sketch gone bad.
Well, yes, the Bielski winter residence will not be Florida.
No, it will not. I mean, I love to visit with the Royal Guard protecting me, but I will not be living there anytime soon.
Well, I know. Hopefully, you get the chance to get out on tour really soon in 2021. I don't know how that looks yet, but you know, how excited are you to be able to get back to live?
I'm thrilled. I mean, and I was so excited with the beginning of the year here going so smoothly in the United States. Effortless.
Yes.
Nothing. So it all looks like it's just rainbows and puppies as far as I can see. I mean, nothing, yeah. Nothing, yeah. Nothing. What could possibly go wrong in the next few days? Yeah, I mean, I'm hoping the world gets to be at least half the world. I mean, I go to bed at night thinking, well, at least 50% of the people on the planet are not idiots. And I'm just hoping we can maintain that wall of 50.
Their album's releasing one day after the apocalypse, so that's good, actually.
Pretty good timing, right? I'll be standing there with, like, my greatest artistic achievement in ashes of some kind of nuclear fallout. That's what I'm feeling. I'll finally made my, you know, Sergeant Pepper that I always dreamed of, and there'll be no living people to hear it.
It's like, hey, look at the irony of me and the Songs for the Apocalypse album.
Who's laughing now?
It's like, yeah, it's just,
perfectly
it's
titled album.
It's Jason Bieler on top of a hill of, like, burnt ash, dropping it'll the mic.
It'll just be me and that guy with the Viking horns from the Capitol building.
Oh, yeah, that's the guy you want to be standing next to.
Yeah, I have a feeling he'll be involved somehow. I don't know how yet.
I wonder if he's musically inclined. You can get him on your next album.
I'll tell you what, you could pick worse frontmen. I mean, he had that confidence behind the speaker's podium. I thought he looked really kind of in command. I was like, that's like, you know, not for nothing, but, you know, David Lee Roth and him in their prime look like they belong in the limelight.
Yep, there's no question.
About the charisma, right?
Yeah. I got to say, like, I did think, you know, when I always pictured the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, I was never thinking that, because that looks right out of a Monty Python's. You couldn't make, like, if I was pitching this to you as a funny thing, you couldn't get a better character.
Nope, it's the fact that this is real life is absolutely amazing in its own way, terrifying yet amazing.
It is terrifying and amazing. I agree with you. Like, I literally, like, when we finish this interview, I'll walk in, I'll turn on the news, and I will not be surprised by anything that happens. Like, Trump eats baby on live CNN. Well, that makes sense. I mean, that seems like the next logical move would be eating a baby on TV. Yes.
Yeah, it's inevitable.
Well, Jason, I know that we are basically out of time with you, and it's a shame because I love talking to you, but we want to give you the chance to tell everybody where they can find Jason Bieler, keep up with the Baron von Bielski Orchestra, and find Songs for the Apocalypse.
Well, thank you very much. I am at jasonbieler.com. I am on Jason Bieler on Twitter, Jason Bieler on Instagram. I think it's Jason Bieler Music on Facebook. I'm on Snapface or Gramchat or whatever the hell the kids are doing today. You can find me on one of those things, and Instaface or whatever. And I think I'm going to start an OnlyFans, if that's okay with you guys. We'll see how that works out.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, that sounds like a great idea.
I think it is. And what would bring about the apocalypse more than a scantily clad Bieler in high def?
I mean, if you're going to go, then, you know, go scantily clad. That's the way I see it.
I agree.
Hey, let me tell you something. You're in a lot better shape than I am. So, you know, you really want to drive the people away. Invite me on in Nepal.
Hey, you're always welcome to join me in the apocalyptic visuals as we approach the end here.
Yes. Well, the end time, at least, you know, if the end times are coming, we got the chance to talk to you and have a great laugh and enjoy your album. So, Jason Bieler, thank you so much. I look forward to another 30 years of listening to you, and all the best.
Gentlemen, thank you so very much for taking the time to both listen to the record and give me a chance to talk about it. I super appreciate it. And I wish you guys all the success and happiness and health moving forward.
Well, thank you. All right.
Take care, guys.
Talk to you soon. Yes. Bye now.
Bye.